This is a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 110th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm super pleased to have with me today Paul Dorey. Hi, Paul.
Hi there, Gary. Thanks for having me here.
Dr. Paul Dorey is director of CSO Confidential and is also a visiting professor of information security at Royal Holloway College, University of London. Paul has 25 years of management experience in InfoSec and established one of the first dedicated operational risk management functions in all of Europe. Paul previously worked for BP, Morgan Greenfell, and Barclays. Paul was one of the founders of the Jericho Forum, as well as the Institute of Information Security Professionals, that is the IISP. Paul lives in the UK outside of London with his family. So thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Let's just start right off. What does a modern CSO do all day anyway? And how do those duties differ from what a CSO did, say, 20 years ago?
Okay, well, certainly 20 years ago, the CISO seemed to spend most of their life thinking about technology. Now the CISO is really talking about business engagement and business risk. So they are firmly part of that executive level conversation that the business has in the C-suite.
So that's the biggest difference. I guess, what are the most important things for a security executive then to know about interacting with the board and the C-suite?
So if you are a genuinely C-level executive, then you have to have that approach, which means that you need to know your business. A good C-level security executive understands what their fellow executives are driven by, what the business priorities are, and actually can articulate the risks pretty clearly so that their colleagues can understand what the main messages are and can come up with the strategies that will support the business.
So that makes sense in the abstract. Can you give a particular example, maybe, or a specific example? So
yeah, people, I think I can give a particularly good one, which is security professionals have found themselves pretty much defending the corporate network. And that's really because there was no way of differentiating between what mattered, i.e. the crown jewels of the company, relative to other assets. And so protect everything, keep it all safe on the network was the goal. What a modern executive can do is actually understand where those critical assets are. You know, do the 80-20 rule and know where the 80% of value is for the 20% of assets.
Right.
And really spend and focus the time on that.
Right. And you feel like that most CSOs, you just have to do that today. Why didn't you have to do that 20 years ago?
Well, you sort of tried. But if you weren't close enough to the business to really understand it, then it meant talking to people and trying to get them to explain what mattered to them. And sometimes they didn't even know where the data was themselves. So we had this sort of strange situation of servers and devices containing things of value, but no one really knew where the things of value were.
I see. So the first CSOs or the first security executives came up out of the IT infrastructure department, knowing about the machines and the places, but not where the stuff was stored necessarily.
Exactly, and they were struggling to articulate what the business impact would be. I remember an embarrassing early conversation I had where I was talking about an attack on a website, and the business reaction surprised me, and they said, "Switch it off."
That's it, and did you?
Well, yeah, that was their instruction. They said, really, we're not doing anything we care about with that site. Close it down.
Uh-huh. That's interesting. And you were surprised by that?
Well, I was, and it taught me to do a fair bit of investigating and not taking things at face value. Just because it has the corporate brand on it doesn't mean it is a primary asset.
Right. So now that we know what CSOs do, where do they come from? Like, what's the ideal background if you want to become a CSO these days?
I think at the moment the CSOs are coming from a whole range of backgrounds. First of all, those who have been around for a while couldn't get any security qualifications because, of course, there weren't any.
Right.
So they pretty much learned on the job. So what you find is you get some who've come through IT. They've learned the language of business. They've learned how to be executives, and so they're able to be at that level. Others have moved sideways from general management, and the challenge for them is actually not to understand the business, but to get credibility with the security guys and the technicians.
Right. So you have to be able to bridge that divide.
Absolutely. And if I was to give a security person a title, I would say the CISO is the Rosetta Stone. It's a translation job.
Right. That's interesting. Where do you go to learn about that? I still don't quite understand, you know, what kind of classes you would take, what kind of career path you should look for.
Some CISOs have gone as far as getting MBAs, and I think that is a useful grounding in business. But frankly, I don't think you need to do that. What you actually need to do is to find some really good business people that you respect and treat them as role models. Just understand how they go about managing the business, understanding where the key priorities lie, and just follow their role.
Right. That makes sense. Speaking of mentoring, you've mentored a number of outstanding CSOs, including Phil Venables from Goldman. What have you learned yourself by mentoring others?
Well, I think I've learned mostly when mentoring others that it is too easy for people not to be ambitious enough, that we look at a problem and we try and solve it incrementally. So, for example, you know, they ask for the $100,000 solution when, frankly, they really need to be asking for $3 million.
Right.
And interestingly enough, the executive can often give $3 million more easily than $100,000.
And why is that?
Because you're really not engaging at the right level. You're not talking about a transformational act,
yeah,
which is frankly what their role is at the senior level of a corporation.
Yeah.
They're not talking about day-to-day little management decisions, because frankly that's what they employ managers for.
Exactly.
It's about big, sweeping executive change.
Yep.
When I was speaking to a CEO, he once said, "What do you think I can do? I can buy companies, I can sell companies, I can hire people and I can fire people, and that's about it."
Right. So thinking big is important.
Very, very important. And I think it's what's held us back from some of these things that we've considered are too big in terms of challenges. And what we really need to say is, you know what? Let's do things very differently. Let's step out. Let's change the way people work.
Did you have a chance to try to put that thought into action in one of your positions?
Yeah, I think the BP experience, when we were starting to work with the Jericho Forum, and frankly, what we started to see was the corporate perimeter was becoming porous. Not only were we putting things out of the corporation, but increasingly third parties and traffic was flowing into the company. And I
Right.
could no longer say that I can defend this network. We called it semi-public.
Right.
And I presented it to a main board director who at that point said to me, so you've given up, have you? At that point, I think I felt I'd lost my job.
Yeah, right.
And I had given up. But in fact, he took the message, and I just said, look, law of diminishing returns, we've got to change what we do. So what we did actually was then put 20,000 people on the internet as their primary corporate network.
Mm-hmm.
And at that point, they then came out of the they came from the outside into the corporation to get their data, rather than the other model, which was typically living inside the company, coming out.
Right, right. So you just turned the thing on its ear.
Absolutely. And that way it became manageable, because we knew what we were protecting. It was that data element.
Yeah, I want to talk a little bit more about deep perimeterization. But first, I want to ask you, as a practicing CSO, what was the biggest win that you had? Maybe that was it. And what was the biggest mistake that you made?
Okay. They may be closely related. The biggest win was discovering my biggest mistake. So when I started working for a company like BP, I saw my job as protecting the IT assets. And it was only following the shock of the terrorism of 9/11 that caused us to sit back, look at a whiteboard and say, what really matters to this organization fundamentally,
right,
and what are the risks? And actually, we went, wait a minute, we've got pipelines, we've got refineries.
Right.
Are they digital? Of course, the answer is increasingly so.
Yep.
So we therefore approached the engineering teams and executive management and said, we think we've come up with a new set of risks that are not in my portfolio. So the deputy chief executive says to me, okay then, so who is accountable for that? And I said, well, it depends. And he said, no, it doesn't, you are.
Right. That's good. I think
that was a great win.
I think there are a lot of organizations that haven't even, or even verticals that haven't come to that realization. Medical devices comes to mind as an example.
Well, absolutely. I think the scope, the error of scope and incorrectly defining scope is one of the big security challenges. So if you think about having a conversation with someone who's protecting their corporate assets, they're worrying about their network, they're worrying about their servers, and then you say, well, wait a minute, what about your cloud services you're using? Mm-hmm. What about your mobile devices? And increasingly, the data that they're managing and the security they need to manage goes completely outside the corporation and is in fact being run by third parties.
Yeah, so that's this notion of deperimeterization, because there is no perimeter. You've argued that for years, and I have too.
So I have, and actually, people think it's a network conversation. They think it's about a firewall.
And it's not, yeah.
No. It's more of an organizational construct. That it's around different organizations looking after the data. As I described it once, it's your crown jewels in someone else's castle.
Right. So without this defined perimeter, how do you practice security? What do you do?
Well, as I say, knowing what your crown jewels are is the fundamental start. Once you know that, you then have to look at who is accountable for applying those controls that would keep it secure. So then we get into this world of the unknowns, and we discover and we find out more about, okay, what third parties are handling our information, what is their security state, how do I find that out, how do I engage them in partnership to achieve our goals. And in the same way, we then discover things like storage areas being used outside the corporation, or different platforms being used in different ways.
Right, that you didn't even know that existed, maybe.
Absolutely. And once you've got that view of scope and a proper understanding, then you really can get to grips with the security challenge of the corporation.
We'll be right back after this message. This is Gary McGraw, your host for the Silver Bullet Security Podcast. If you like what you're hearing here, you should check out my monthly security column published by Search Security and Information Security Magazine. You can find the most recent column at searchsecurity.com/McGraw. All of my writings are collected on my webpage at www.sigital.com/gem/writings. Thanks for listening. So I want to talk a little bit about building security, and you know, I'm a major proponent of that and security engineering. And I wonder if that is in the purview of the modern CSO. What do you think about that notion?
Well, the thing I haven't talked about is strategy. And one of the big differences of an executive conversation, not only does it involve multi-millions rather than tens of thousands, but it actually involves bigger and transformational changes that relate to strategy, not relate directly to operations.
Right.
So security used to be an operational risk issue, and now it is a strategic issue. So an operational solution to problems with software is your patch-in. A strategic solution to problems with software is you engineer it incorrectly.
Right.
And you transform the way you go about business.
Right.
That is fundamental. And, of course, increasingly, people are using third parties to supply their software. And so we have to apply the same rules to them as we would apply to our development teams.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that that North America and the United States is ahead of Europe when it comes to that sort of thinking. Do you agree with that?
I would think to some extent. There's a better understanding around the real engine room of software development in the US, I think, than there is in parts of the UK. I wouldn't be completely sweeping when you consider how much core software is actually developed, for example, in mobile platforms and things.
Yeah, or multinational banks, many of which have London presences.
Exactly. But I think more consistently across the US, it is the case that people are getting to grips of what it means to have a software shop supporting them And there are parts of Europe where that's quite new.
So what can we do to accelerate the understanding in Europe?
Well, I think it all falls down, really, to the CISO. But we are increasingly seeing CISOs appear in European organizations. And if they are to have this strategic conversation, then quite quickly they will tackle things like, wait a minute, is our scope right? Wait a minute, how do we fix things? One fix, multiple solutions across across our whole platform.
Mm-hmm.
So answers like build it in come quite quickly to that that type of debate and thinking.
Right, once you've had that realization.
Exactly. So you'd expect it to form part of people's platforms. I think most disappointingly, I haven't seen many enterprise risk registers for the ERM of a corporation contain that type of risk yet.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about that. So how can the notion of building security in be represented in a management dashboard like that?
Well, the risks defined in a typical ERM likelihood by impact type matrix are pretty diverse. So you're pretty much open to defining what you want these dots to be. I think a core dot could well be fundamentally trusted or untrusted software platform.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I think that's a good start. I think that one of the dangers of a risk management approach, though, when it comes to software, is that you can completely ignore low-risk pieces of software if you do it wrong. And I think it's important that we cover the entire portfolio, even the low-risk stuff, in a non-zero way. That is, the whole portfolio needs to be considered in some fashion so that the bar is not set below water.
I would guess so, but perhaps I would argue more again of this 80-20 thing. I think 80% of the software does need proper attention. I think there's probably the sandwich ordering machine that you can, you know, take a bit of risk with.
Yeah, but I mean, look, tell that to Target, who got hacked through their HVAC vendor.
Oh,
right?
Absolutely. So, okay, it's a good pushback. And I would say that when we look at the asset, people tend to say, okay, we'll protect that system. But, of course, we have to protect the context in which that system operates.
Exactly. So I think that you have to set some sort of minimum threshold for everything, and then you got to apply the 80-20 rule above that for the high-risk stuff.
Yeah, I think I'm prepared to push some of it out into the Wild West.
Are you?
I just say, hey, you know, anything out there, take your chances.
I think we've done too much of that lately, but we can talk about that more offline. I do think that we're seeing more CSOs in the States begin to talk about full portfolio coverage at some small level without ignoring the 80-20 rule. You know.
Well, and if I was to take on board what a number of police forces have encountered, which is the zero tolerance approach.
Right.
If you allow minor crimes to occur, then big ones happen too.
I like it. You can be on my team now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So you get rid of the broken windows, and all of a sudden the crime rate drops.
Exactly.
Yeah, I think that's true. Let's talk about academia a little bit. So, mm-hmm. in your role as a visiting professor, how do you see academic computer security stack up against what we might call practical security or security as practiced in corporations?
It's a big spectrum, Gary. So you can look at incredibly purist academic work where you do start to say, well, where would we ever find that to be useful? Along with the middle ground, which actually creates rather surprising things, like suddenly shocking us that they can break crypto we've relied upon for years.
Right. Yeah.
To the actually quite close to engineering style academia, where people are generally working lists of problems that have been provided by companies, and that's the reason I'm a visiting professor. So Roel Holloway, University of London, actually said to me, "Come and be part of our environment to help with that bridge."
Ah.
And actually bring us more real commercial problems that we can solve.
So we sort of get our hands dirty, so to speak, and know what the real world is interested in.
Absolutely, and the pleasure I get as well is to sometimes bring things back inside corporations where they say, well, frankly, this is really impossible, and we say, well, no, it isn't, actually. Academics have good answers, they just haven't told you yet.
Yeah, that's good. I think that people like Ross Anderson really help, too. Ross's work is very much grounded in the real world, even though there's plenty of theory and academic muscle behind it.
Yeah, there have been a whole range of academics working in different areas. I think when we move into some of these new technologies that are more like engineering than IT, such as the Internet of Things, then I think we will see more cross-fertilization.
Yeah, so let's talk about Internet of Things. You know that Internet is just a collective noun for things, right?
Yeah, I think that's a good definition. So the big challenge for me on Internet of Things is really around both scale, in that we really have never seen the number of devices that we are starting to predict that will be deployed. And that's going to change the dynamics, plus the fact that they will start to operate a lot more autonomously and seamlessly, so that our sort of band-aid solutions, where humans have got to step in all the time, really aren't going to work.
Yeah. I see that too, but I also see a massive problem with just plain old trust modeling. I mean, if you asked a normal person how much should you trust your dishwasher versus your refrigerator, I think they'd look at you like you were crazy.
Yeah, and how much should you trust your health device when it suddenly becomes used for medical applications?
Yeah, right. Yeah, because, you know, and a lot of this stuff is going to be free, and in the typical Silicon Valley sense, if it's free, that means you're the product or your data.
And the track record at the moment for the early stages of deployment is not great.
Well,
it's on the statement, Gary, by the way.
Yeah, well, it's kind of like you got all these free 8088 chips sitting around in the warehouse, and you might as well use them. So you overpower the device, and you drop a TCP stack on there, and off you go.
Yeah. Really, we have to step up the challenge here to say, let's stop deploying things that will be a problem pretty quickly, and perhaps a problem that we can't solve. One of the security consultancies, and I won't name them, actually published something on their website telling users that they must patch their devices and they must change the passwords to complex ones. I'm thinking, the end user may not even know there's a device in the thing they just bought.
You know, the good news is, Paul, those people don't read that website.
Yeah. Quite.
Yeah, so when the normals get the geek stuff, we always have trouble. We had the same thing happen with cell phones, and, you know, a lot of us predicted that these were going to be a massive security issue, which they are, of course, today. And we had a chance to get in front of it, but we just didn't do it. Why do you think we will do something different this time when it comes to Internet of Things?
I'm hopeful that the transformation will come about for the very reason that we now have executive engagement talking to the CISO.
Aha.
We're talking about a big change, and a change in the way we do things, and it's the guys at the top that can do that. And now they're having the conversation, not the 15-minute dutiful presentation to the board that I used to give years ago.
Yep.
But now the 1 hour, 15-minute, overrunning their agenda because they're asking so many questions and they're so engaged on this topic. I think we're in a different place.
Well, that's good. So you're optimistic that we can take advantage of that.
I am. And frankly, if we don't, there's no one's fault but ours.
That's good. So you heard it here. It's no one's fault but Paul's.
Probably like that.
Great. Last question from left field. What is your favorite piece of humorous fiction? As a Brit, you got to have one.
Oh, gosh. I've got to go back to history. I think it's probably the whole Hitchhiker's Guide.
Oh, me too. I have that as my example in case we got stuck.
Yeah. It's a wonderful combination of irony and sad truth around things like government bureaucracy.
Oh, I know. You know, Douglas Adams had a way of talking about technology that was so funny. He's just very funny when he takes on tech.
flying saucers hanging in the air in the same way that bricks don't.
Perfect. Well, thank you for your time today, Paul. It's been very interesting.
Thank you, Gary. I very much enjoyed it.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Sigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by Search Security. The March-April 2015 issue of IEEE S&P Magazine is a special issue devoted to the Oakland Security Conference. The issue also features our interview with Whit Diffie. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.sigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.